The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining me for another Heretics Hour. Actually, 2 hours. It is October 7th, 2013, and today was another exquisite day where I live in South Texas. The sky was an intense blue all the way down to the horizon, something I thought we might never see again during the years of the so-called chemtrails that were so often covering our skies. Now, I want to comment on this because of the way the sky looked today. And I have not seen, I've been thinking for about a week now, because there was some discussion on the internet about whether chemtrails were just another conspiracy theory, fostered by people like Alex Jones, or I'm one who has seen quite a lot of it in my skies over the last, 6-7 years since they were first pointed out to me. And it's been amazing. It's amazing to see it. And so I cannot think that they're just normal engine exhaust of airplanes. But I was thinking since this discussion that we had that I haven't seen any for quite a while. And I don't, have a very good sense of how much time has gone by from the last time I noticed them. And I thought, well, maybe I haven't been outside as much and didn't see the skies, but actually, probably am. And, I just haven't, seen any. So I would say at least 6 months, and it's probably been longer than that, but I'd say, at least 6 months, I haven't seen them, and never. It was always, every week or two or something, and for several days, and sometimes more often than that, for such a long time. And so I have to ask, has it stopped for good? I mean, one can only hope so. And I have to say that if these chemtrails that we see, these fluffy, ugly kind of lines, cloudy lines crossing the sky that get thicker and thicker, spread out into a haze. If they're just ordinary airplane exhaust, how is it we suddenly have no planes in the sky now when we had so many before? And they were there on certain days and not on every day. So this explanation really makes no sense. But I'm going to keep watching to see if they show up and report it if they do. Well, I've been a little blah today. I think it's because I worked really hard yesterday. During the evening, I put up the new post of Leopold Wenger's letters from Oschatz Air Base and Pilsen Flight Training School from late 1939 and 1940 with lots of pictures. I worked a lot on info for this program earlier in the day, and I find I can't work hard 2 days in a row anymore. It seems that if I have a burst of energy one day, I pay the next. So I do hope you will go to CarolynYeager.net and read these letters and look at the pictures, and just to appreciate my efforts and the efforts also of David Coyle, who did the translating and is still translating the rest of them. So, okay, can Adolf Hitler be criticized? This might seem like a silly question, but I came up with some new conclusions on this just recently when in some heavy discussion pertaining to just generally the question, could Adolf Hitler have prevented World War II if he had behaved differently toward Czechoslovakia and Poland? Now, this is kind of another way of blaming Hitler for the war, saying if he hadn't done this or that, he could have done that. This is quite a question, though, if it would be prevented. Is it, could Poland have prevented World War II, or could England and France have prevented World War II if they had behaved differently? Well, we might ask that question, but the mainstream Jew media does not ask this. So, however, I'm not going to go into these issues tonight. I'm not going to try to answer these questions. The only issue I want to get into is what is the result of bringing up questions like this. Without clear evidence brought to bear, it's just idle speculation, or as someone put it, an intellectual exercise. And should we be, you know, with the dire straits that we're in as a white race, and I'm always talking to white people about the white race, white people who care about the white race, can we afford intellectual exercises about questions like this? Now I'm going to come up with my answer to that question, but I do want to, since I brought this up, talking about, you know, white people, there are, well, today I was reminded that there are an awful lot of really dumb, I don't know what to call them, stupid, confused or just lazy or something, white people. But I don't, Tan Staffel doesn't like attacking white people and thinks it's a big mistake. So I try to refrain from doing that. But, you know, we have white people who are for the white race, who are for other white people. And then we have white people who are not for white people and who take up the staunching, if you will, for, non-whites and would prefer to defend and look after the interests of non-whites rather than whites. Keep that distinction in mind. Of course, I'll probably mention it again. But my answer to the question on, can we afford the intellectual exercise or the speculation, whatever, about that would in some way question our leaders of our good leaders, you know, whether they made mistakes, how many mistakes they made or so on, is that in the larger picture, what's most important is our worldview, or Weltanschauung, that wonderful German word that cannot be fully appreciated in translation of something like worldview, but that's basically, you know, what it is. But it takes in quite a bit, I'm told, like the culture, the language, the people, the whole view that comes from a certain group that shares this Weltanschauung. In my worldview, okay, we have the Jew or New World Order versus an order of united white people whose job is to resist Jews completely. I mean, that is, that's what it boils down to. We are obliged to be trying to create our Jew-free world, because we are convinced that, and this was Adolf Hitler's position, that we cannot live side by side with Jews, because we know the damage that they have constantly and always been creating in our societies. So the world order, and that the world view that we have to have is very simple one, and might seem way too simple, and for a lot of people, and they do think it's too simple. But I think we can simplify it down to, if we have to simplify it to the very basics, it is that we have white people who care about protecting and defending their white traditions, culture, and even survival up against this New World Order, which is also a Jew World Order. I don't know which came first, but I would say the Jew World Order, and then it became the New World Order. But it is one in which the interests of white people are absolutely disregarded and are more and more considered to be expendable, and we're supposed to even understand that. And a lot of white people have joined in and said, yes, so we don't think that white interests are important, and we're not going to look after white interests anymore. So, now my basic argument today, as I think I already said, is not about answering individual criticisms. In fact, my argument is that we should not still be making them. That's basically what I'm trying to say here today. And if you really don't know and you think it's important, then you're required to do some serious research to get the best information on it, not rely on sensationalist or stupid, and being entertained by anti-Hitler websites and so on to come up with your information. If you don't know, what I mean by that is if you don't know what is the correct answer to these questions I'm bringing up, then you need to find out. If you don't know, let's say, my notes are pretty crummy here. If you don't know that Hitler was a good guy and think that he might have been the bad guy, then you need to find out. But you're not going to find out on some of these Henry Mackow type websites. So let me go on here. And that other thing I'm asking is anything accomplished by doing this kind of criticism? And maybe I haven't really gone into the criticism itself well enough, but I'm just depending on my memory to do that. Okay. Basically, the point I want to make is that Hitler was, I was talking about there's a good side and there's a bad side. You know, that's basically what I'm saying. I'm saying that it's pretty clear that we have the right side and the wrong side. We have the good side, we have the bad side. And I do think in terms of sides. I do. And I think that as I was pointing out in the dire condition that we're in now, we need to be very clear about this. We can't really afford to go looking at little this little point here, that little point here, or trying to come up with new arguments or bring forth old arguments, whatever, about this. We shouldn't be arguing about this. And I know I am one who does a lot of criticizing of people in the so-called movement, but I don't consider that. When I think about it, I don't consider that it is the same thing as what I'm talking about, because I'm saying that people have to be really on the right side. They can't be seeming to be on the right side or pretending to be or just thought to be, because they're partway there, but not all the way there, and therefore they're not working fully in our interest, and they can't be working against our interest. So I'm going to bring up some examples in a moment here that will explain some of this better, what I mean by this. But so as I'm saying, Adolf Hitler was on the right side of every issue. If you think in terms of the white race and the white survival and which is dependent on getting Jews out of our societies and ending their meddling in our affairs. He is one of the prime people who we can point to. And so in spite of what might be, some things that some people might see as not being ideal or not being exactly the way they'd like it, we have to keep that in mind, that he was on the right side of every issue, and his enemies were on the wrong side of every issue. Now, not just Churchill and Roosevelt were on the wrong side, but because they were actually on the side of the Jews, because they were working, they had so many Jews working with them and within their governments and advising them and so on. But the issue of the Slavic peoples comes up a lot when it comes to Adolf Hitler. And I'm not really prepared to to go into that a lot right at the moment, but I just think I better mention it. And again, you have to say, what side were they on? Were they clearly and definitely? Now, I will say, I'm going to get into more than I probably want to, hope I don't get lost in this, but I will say that it's clear, especially from table talk, that Hitler wanted to, in a sense, colonize the eastern part of the of Europe and east and the western part of Russia for Europeans and for Germans and Germanic people that he wanted to join in his join with the Germans in his campaign. And he wanted to do it for the protection and the defense of Europe and Europeans. And this meant that the Slavic peoples were, if everything went the way he would have liked it to go, I think, would have not had their national sovereignty, but would have been would not have been turned into slaves either, would have been in perfectly good shape, but they would not have been in control because the Germans were going to be in control. The Germans were going to be the administrators. The Germans are going to make the decisions. And the other peoples there were going to share in the benefits of the good life that was going to be created, but it was not going to be their own sovereign situations, put it that way. I'm not sure what could have evolved in time, you know, with cooperation. But there was this thing of Slavic nationalism. And, of course, at one time there was a very strong pan-Slavism nationalism. And there were now, you know, since World War One, and the enemies of the good are enemies at Versailles, the Jews playing a very large role in that, had set it up that Poland got quite a bit of German territory and was now this big Polish Republic, and that made them very happy, and that the Czechs got their own country for the first time in history, and they had their Czechoslovakia, and they had to share it with the Slovaks, but the Slovaks were pretty much on the east and the Czechs on the west, pretty much. And the Czechs were the majority, so they, you know, were in control, and they lorded it over the minorities that they had there. So it's always somebody's going to be lording it over if they have the ability to do so. The Poles were lording it over their minorities too. And then there were the Ukrainians who were still pretty dominated by the Soviet Union, I think. I can't get into that, but they also have their own nationalist aspirations, very much so, and they were mainly in opposition with the Poles. There was a lot of conflict between the Poles and the Ukrainians during that time. So there was all this nationalism, and what Hitler wanted to do was to do something that didn't take that into account, you know. I mean, that where that didn't fit in. And, of course, the Germans needed agricultural land and did not have really sufficient or that good of agricultural land. The Germans were able to make the most out of what agricultural land they had, but it wasn't sufficient. And he saw, particularly in the Ukraine, all that rich, wonderful farmland that he thought, well, they could just, the Germans could get in there, and if they were in charge, you know, they could just turn that into a wonderful place. And he saw the Baltic, not the Baltic, the Black Sea as a wonderful, you know, vacation resort area, and he just saw all these things. And he just decided that Slavic nationalism was not going to work with his plan. And so that's why I think, and this could be argued, I'm not an expert on this, but that's what I think why, he didn't feel he could go that route of, there are other reasons too, but go the route of trying to make the Slavs, the Czechs, and the Ukrainians mainly his kind of like partners in this, and leave them, you know, leave them alone and have them fight on his side, because that wasn't going to go all that well, because they weren't going to go along with what his ideas were. So, but we have to say, we have to see that the Germans were capable of doing all this if they didn't have the, if they had not had the adversariness of all these others, both on the east and on the west. They were capable of creating all this, and they would not have, I'm not going to even say it, but I don't think they would. They weren't going to be really mistreating people, but they were going to be, people were going to have to go along with the Germans being in charge. So this was, whether this was unfair or was not unfair anyway, is not the point is that what Hitler had was good for the white race. It was good for white people. It was good for Europe and European people. And the Jews would have been removed from all of this area, and we would have had the strength to keep them out. But rather than caring more about getting rid of their Jews, you know, the Poles and the Czechs and so on, well, let's just look at the Poles. They were supposed to have been so anti-Semitic. We constantly hear about how anti-Semitic they are. They still are. But yet when it comes to talking about agreeing that what Hitler did was okay, they absolutely refused to do that. And they say, oh, it's terrible. We would never do that. We would never turn our Poles over, you know, I mean, our Jews over to Hitler. Oh, we'd never do that. Now, then they're busy protecting 3 million Jews, so they say they would have done. And he was in the wrong for wanting to deport them. Say, does this make sense? It doesn't make sense. And there's, well, that's another whole huge issue. And of course, this book from The Revisionist is something that will shed a lot of light on that. So I'm going to be going into that more. So I've gone off a little bit here because these are questions that people bring up right away. So I thought I maybe better address it a little bit, but I'm not pretending like I'm doing a great job of it. Now, so to just go on here with what I've got some notes on, not very good notes, but so who was the greatest, who were the greatest people here in Central and Eastern Europe? Germans. And who was the greatest leader? Hitler. And so, you know, should not we let the best and the greatest work for us and do for us? I think so. But of course, you know, everybody knows I'm partial to Germans and I'm German heritage, so I don't have that. I don't have a problem with being, you know, having some other Slavic blood in me and wanting, you know, feeling loyal to that. But I don't think that. I'm not going to go into that anymore. Another issue is disregarding the small things, letting things go by because they're not enough to bother about. By ignoring mistakes and criticism of someone like Hitler, they call preserving unity. Okay, you know, I'm often accused of being divisive and of by my criticism of other people in the movement. I'm foregoing the unity that we need, and I'm harming that unity, and I'm creating divisiveness. There's this idea that, though, there's an idea just in general among people, you know, of to how to live a happy life. Don't sweat the small stuff, right? You know, disregard small things. Let things go by because they're not enough to bother about. Now, this you see is where I realize I'm a detailed person, but this is something that I feel has to be looked at in another light, or not just in that one way. Because by letting little things go by, a lot of things go wrong. And by ignoring mistakes that people are making. A lot of harm can be done. And so you can say these people will not think this way about, say, what I'm doing, but they will use this when you talk about criticizing someone like Hitler. And they say, well, should we ignore it if he's, you know, of course he's dead now, he's gone, you're not going to change anything by talking about it. You're only going to kind of retaliate or somehow make Hitler's enemies look better or whatever. You're not going to change anything. But, you know, I don't know what I've got written here. How can unity be built on such dissonance? Well, I'm talking now in favor of not criticizing Adolf Hitler. You know, if we're going to look to what is the best direction that we can go to, and who was the one who showed us the way, and who was the most impressive leader that we've had, and who did the most, even though it failed in the end. And we know there's every reason why it failed, because it didn't have to be his fault, because of all that was gathered together in against him and against what it was in our own best interest. So this this then is a different well, it seems to me that this criticism of Hitler is quite different from criticizing all these lesser people in the movement if they're playing too much footsie with the other side. And that's basically what my concern is, when they're either being selfish, totally selfish and just looking for money in their own, you know, looking for income, or whether they're too cozy with the other side. I'm very much on sides now, because I think when you're in dire straits, you better all pull together on your side, or you're not going to have a chance at all. So trying to correct what a great leader like Adolf Hitler has done by sort of the idea, well, let's be brutally honest here. Let's just really look this over. Let's not try to cover up or, you know, protect him. He's just human, and obviously nobody's perfect, and he made mistakes, and we should want to know what these mistakes are. Maybe for someone else, I might have some sympathy for that, but I don't have it for him, towards him, because I think this does interfere with the kind of unity we could have if we would unify behind a single great idea. And nobody personifies this single great idea better than Hitler does for all of us. You know, in spite of the fact that it's difficult for some people, some of the ones I was just talking about, but nobody personifies this idea like him. And there are a lot of people who think so, so there's a whole lot of what I might call Adolf Hitler worship, or people who are just, you know, thrilled with images from the Third Reich and so on. Well, I like them too, but I do not want you to think, though, that I, and I've said this before, though, but I don't want you to think that I am in favor of turning Hitler into some kind of divinity, or making a religion out of Hitler, or, you know, in the way that, say, Matt Cale has kind of does. Well, he does. He sort of turned it into a religion. National Socialism and Hitler and other people have said seriously that they think we should build a religion around Hitler to take the place of Christianity and things like that. I don't belong with that at all. I like to think of Hitler as a man, and while he was an ordinary human, he was a extra special human being in every regard. And so, if you can find somebody who is a better person to stand behind and unify behind, then come up with it. This is my idea why I'm finding myself kind of not accepting criticism about Hitler's tactics and Hitler's methods and so on at this date. Because while these people are even fans of Hitler and are not, you know, and will say, well, they like a lot of what he did. You know, a lot of it is that everybody loves, not everybody, but all people on our side, love what Hitler did up until 1939 or 1938. Oh, just wonderful what he did in Germany. But then when he tried to go into the Slavic countries and didn't, I don't want to take too much time, but you know, what was left of the Czechoslovakia, with turning the Bohemia Moravia into a protectorate. There was no harm done to the Czechs ever. And the Czechs they wanted the Czechs to cooperate, and, the Czechs didn't have any damage from the war, you know? They didn't have any damage from any kind of bombing, and they didn't have to fight. They weren't called up, they just didn't get any harm. Now the Poles did, because the Poles resisted and did not cooperate, were unwilling to cooperate in the beginning, and so it turned into a conflict of great hatefulness, and it could have been done differently from their side also, as we know, but we don't have time to get into that. All right. I guess I'll just move on here, so I can cover everything. Speaking of our side, and speaking of people who are if you understand what's at stake, and that, or if you're just engaging in intellectual exercises. Well, I listened to two radio programs today that have been featured lately on the Daily Stormer website. And the first one was one that's very new there, but it's been quite a few shows, because I guess this guy does a program every night for like a half hour, because that's what seemed to be the length of the one I listened to. I hadn't listened to any of them. I wasn't interested in them. This is Robert Schlattman, who has this program called Our German Ancestry. And the one I listened to is Lone Wolves and Berserkers, that I maybe just went up today. I was quite surprised at how terrible it was. I mean, just terrible. And I wonder if they are listening, to these shows before they post them, why aren't they more particular in what they're posting? Or if they're not listening to them because they just think that the title sounds good and the guy's name, suppose he's supposed to be a German. Well, he's certainly got a German name, but he's a German American. He might be very sincere, but he actually sounded in this program as it went on like he was insane. He sounds insane. So I just thought I'd mention that, because after that, and right next to it at the Daily Stormer, was Wolf Wall Street, whose program Fourth Position with Wolf Wall Street. And I don't listen to his either, but I just can't bring myself to care for him at all. And I don't like his philosophy even, or his approach to things. He's associated with Tom Metzger, and he considers himself Fourth Position, which is very critical. He's a sort of a national socialist, but different, not a Hitler national socialist, but Strasser Brothers fan. And he doesn't really, in my opinion, understand a whole lot, but he thinks he does. And brought this. I listened to this program, Attrition or Death. And I was actually cooking, and so I thought I'd listen to something. Otherwise, I couldn't just sit and listen to these shows. But I did, and it got into, somebody called in. I think he was a host at the, I never can remember the name of that. I always want to say Righteous, Renegade Broadcasting. I think he was. I thought he said his name was Jim, but I didn't find any Jim there. But anyway, they were talking, and it came up, the Strasser brothers. And Wolf Wall Street's, and he has a name, which I wish he'd use instead of Wolf Wall Street. But he came out again with his idea that that Hitler betrayed the working class. He betrayed the National Socialist Party. He betrayed his real supporters, particularly with the Night of the Long Knives, with the getting rid of the SA in favor of the Wehrmacht and going for the support of the elites and all of that. And he, it's kind of half-baked because Hitler was wanting to unite all segments of Germany. And I think that his idea was superior, absolutely. The other one is very communist style. It's very class divisive, and they don't apologize for that. The Strassers, especially Otto Strasser, was. But Wolf Wall Street, this other guy was arguing with him a little bit with it. He didn't agree with his interpretation of Hitler's actions, and saying that under the Fuhrer principle, nobody could go in and tell Hitler what to do, unless you just got rid of him. And Wall Street was trying to argue that he needed to be forced to do the right thing, and he had needed this and that, and whatever. Anyway, I find all this such a waste. I don't think it gets any of us anywhere, but of course people are going to do what they want to do. But he would be an example, Wolf Wall Street, of somebody who thinks he's really working for the white cause, but he's not, in my opinion, he's not accomplishing anything. And I wouldn't even mind having a kind of a debate with him if I were able to. It's not really my area, but I wouldn't mind talking with him. I guess I can invite him on my show. It hasn't occurred to me that it sounds like such an ordeal. I don't want to put myself through. But I suppose he would probably accept speedily. So maybe I will have to think about that. But I don't usually go into the detail of all of this, because I don't have time to study up on it, and do all the programs I do and so on. So I don't know what will come from that. But another thing that I can bring up here is that this email I got from David Marshall today, and it was after I sent out my mailer for this show, and because of that, he sent me this email, and he said, I recognize the necessity for the rehabilitating of Hitler, but meaning, in making him more acceptable to the public, but Hitler as military leader troubles me. I don't see him as always great in this regard. There is the issue of the no retreat order, the premature stoppage of new weapons technology research, the halt of a certain advance during Kursk in order to respond to the Sicilian invasion by the Allies, he puts in parentheses, Normandy, the Tunisian mass surrender of 400,000 troops, that's it, he says, etc. Unless these are just more disinfo, there is a need to rehabilitate Hitler's reputation on these points, if possible. Did he lose the war due to his own incompetence? Now, then he asks another question, but I'll just stop here and deal with this. Now, for somebody who's been around a while, like I think this person has been, But I don't know what he's filling his head with. But to even consider that he lost the war due to his own incompetence, to even consider that at once the United States came into the war, and once the Soviet Union was continuing to turn out and more munitions and so on, and their industrial output and all the resources that they had at their disposal to do so, how Hitler could ever have won that war, it was not possible. But that he held out so long is amazing. And of course, what people generally criticize is that he shouldn't have held out so long. He should have tried to surrender. Well, he actually did try to work out surrender proposals, surrender agreements. He actually did. He was even willing to leave the Reich, to give up the leadership for a good treaty that would give Germany a fair break, you know, and to continue on. He was willing to leave. He did a lot of this. He was not a hard-headed person, but the Allies never wanted that. They wanted total victory from the beginning. And Roosevelt knew that by the time he was able to get America into the war, they would start winning. And he just had to manage to do that against lots of opposition in the United States. So some of these questions are, you know, kind of dumb, and a little bit of thinking seems like would clarify things. I had to look up a lot of these things he mentioned because I didn't think they were they were what he was implying, but I wanted to be sure. Well, this retreat order, there was this, when Hitler took over as commander-in-chief, he declared a no retreat policy to Halder, who was his main, at that time, the main, I get these things mixed up, I haven't been working with him enough, but, his main, on his end, not on the Wehrmacht end, but on his end of the leadership, Halder was the chief, field marshal and commander or whatever under him. And so Halder accepted it, but Halder was always kind of disloyal to Hitler and never really worked well with him. But the no retreat order saved the day in certain battles. It was successful more often than it was not. There came a time when they may have held on a little longer, and in the end, they didn't. They had to retreat. Now, if they had not retreated, and then they had ended up winning, or not having to retreat at all and being able to regroup and so on, then it would be a different story. So why just look at a few instances where they didn't retreat, and then in the end they had to retreat anyway, and in worse shape than they would have been earlier. That's what you call cherry picking. Then he mentions a premature stoppage of new weapons technology research. Well, there's none of that. That doesn't even exist, except the only thing I found was a Henry Mackow article that Hitler was testing nuclear bombs, but he stopped or something. Stupid Henry Mackow. What a. Anybody who's reading his stuff, I'll just mention that, I don't have any respect for. Now, the halt of certain advance during Kursk, there was no such thing. There was no halt of the advance during Kursk. There was postponed quite a number of times, not just in response to the Sicily invasion by the Allies, but it had been postponed for a lot of reasons, and eventually it was carried out quite a bit later than it originally was intended to be. But it didn't seem to any of the generals that the later time period would made it made its success unlikely because they were the ones who wanted to put it off. Many of the generals wanted to put it off for a later time so they could be better prepared and so on. That's all I can say about that, though. And then supposedly he brings up the mass surrender in Tunisia, 400,000 troops. Well, was this Hitler's fault? You know, when you lose, you lose, and your men are there. I guess he should have known better than to leave them there. I mean, he should have been able to control all of these things. Other leaders are not able to do it, but he should have been able to do it, according to this person. So, he says, if this is just more disinfo, well, I think it's a lot of disinfo, and I think people throw this stuff out. You see, here's a whole number of things aimed at Hitler's handling of the war that I don't think hold much water. They're not worth much, but this guy or people don't really look into them. They just read about them on sites and forums and so on where people want to be are critical, want to be criticizing Hitler and as a general and so on, really get off on that. And they make it sound convincing and they make it sound like they know what they're talking about. But if you really look into it, all of these issues are so complex. This is not like a good guys, bad guys thing that I was talking about in the beginning. When you start talking about all these decisions in the war and all the people involved and all the context that it's in and the previous, what happened previously and, then all the treason and all the false information and these are not simple things to say, well, you know, Hitler made this terrible mistake. Now this guy also brought up, this David Marshall brought up Heinrich Himmler, and he said, what about the arrest warrant issued to capture Himmler? Hitler said Himmler was a traitor the last week of the war. Can you tell us about this, too? Well, everybody, we all like Himmler now, all us on the side that we're on our good side. All of us on our side, we like Himmler now. Hitler was furious at Himmler because Himmler did go, you know, he thought everything was lost, and they all had this idea that they got from who knows where that Hitler was down in this bunker and he didn't know what was going on and he wasn't, you know, using best judgment anymore. He wasn't at his best and he wasn't doing anything. And they saw this tragedy for Germany, and so they tried to do something about it. Hitler felt that he was fully in command of his faculties, and the evidence, in spite of his physical problems he was having, his physical health, the evidence shows that he was in command of all his faculties right up to the end. And he was determined to keep command and not let all the various parties go off on their own and start doing things on their own, which he knew would be disastrous. And you know that even though once he finally accepted that the war was totally lost and Berlin was going to be overrun and he was going to, you know, commit suicide, he did create a government. He named people for the government, and I'm sure he did hope that it would carry on. And he named good people for this government. Of course, he wanted Goebbels to be in it, but Goebbels didn't want to stay alive either in this new world. So, but he had a government that was actually under that wonderful man Dönitz trying to, you know, function, and it was functioning, and all kinds of people were functioning and following orders, and then when Himmler tried to make this deal, so the word came back to Hitler on his own, as though he were now, you know, the Führer, not just the Reichsführer SS. Hitler was furious, yeah, and said, okay, that's it. You know, he was very hurt by it too, and it was the same with Göring. Göring also thought that, well, now he should take over before the end came, because Hitler was, you know, down in that bunker and couldn't do anything, and he was going to, you know, he told people to report to him, or he was going to talk to the enemy or something. And he wasn't. See, Hitler knew that they were not going to be able to do anything either. He knew that this was not. There was no possibility. He had already done everything, and he knew what the Allies had in mind. Well, I think he probably didn't think it was as bad as it was going to be. He would thought it would be as bad as World War One was, the end of World War One, but maybe not as bad as World War Two, the end of, you know, with Nuremberg and all that. But it was. So I don't feel that he was, you know, nutty or anything to call Himmler a traitor and to put out an arrest warrant for him. Of course, Himmler got arrested by the British before that ever happened, and we know what they did. So his ideas about working out a deal were never going to come to anything. Now, I had a very clear idea last week, I thought, about how I felt that this criticism of Hitler was not, should not take place. But I think that it seemed so clear and clarifying to me at the time, because I would have, previous to that, I would have not been able to stand up to people who said, well, you know, Hitler did this wrong, Hitler did that wrong, and I would say, well, you know, maybe, you know, and, you know, look at it. But I would, you know, I wasn't ready to say, well, we should not be criticizing him. But it occurred to me, it just occurred to me from this, from that experience last week, that something that I maybe failed in myself somewhat. And that is that if we are going to be a united force, and I guess the only point I've had in all this is that if we're going to be a united force and we're going to unite behind something that is strong and powerful enough, or, you know, convincing enough to us that we can unite behind it, it would be Hitler. Because there is nothing better than that. And there is no one who has demonstrated all the being in the light, being for all the right things, all the way. And that includes, very, very important, having the right attitude toward the Jews. And this is where so many people fall down and fail, in my opinion. So I hope you're hearing that. That's probably the biggest thing that I have to say here, is that so much of this, where we want to somehow stay away from Adolf Hitler, and we want to criticize Adolf Hitler to the point that we can say, well, he really failed and we need to do it differently. You know, he was a failure. It's because of him this happened and that happened and all these disasters happened. We don't have to follow that anymore, and we're going to find something else a little bit different. Well, these are always people, always, who end up being Jew friendly. They do not have the backbone or the spine or the whatever, or the sense or the clarity, whatever, to see that, that we have to be firm on the Jews. And I'm not talking about, because I don't really like people who just go, you know, start attacking Jews. And one thing I don't like at all about Wolf Wall Street is his kike Jew word, you know. And to me, it occurred to me today that he uses that word kike Jew all the time because he himself is not against all Jews. So he distinguishes the bad Jews by calling them kike Jews. Why else? I think so. I really think so. In fact, I would like to talk to him about that very thing. You know, why do you say kike Jew? Why don't you just say Jew or say kike? Because it's like somebody saying Zionist Jews. But he's not going to say that, so he comes up with this other thing. Because in everything he talks about, it doesn't sound like he's ready to see that in a clear light. And so I'm glad that I'm associated with Tan Stoffel on the White Network. I've been, you know, always been glad about it. I've never, ever had any, had been sorry in the least or had any reservations or think I could have done something better, because most people are not strong in this. And I'm just so happy that he is, and he's happy that I am. So that works out real well. But I was going to say that I don't like the idea of bashing Jews, just right and left, you know, and all this anti-Jew talk, and it gets kind of silly and kind of ridiculous. I mean, we have to remain intelligent. We can't just use name-calling and insulting phrases and also just the same old things that you see in comments. You know, people write comments. I don't know who these people are because they don't use real names or anything, but they just write these same comments about Jews and so on. And it gets so tiresome and it seems so stupid. It doesn't make us look good, and they certainly don't look good. So, you know, while the problem is Jews, we need to approach it in an intelligent way and talk about it in an intelligent way, like we do on the White Network. And sometimes I might go a little bit too far, but most of the time I guess I don't. So, you know, this is, we have to keep it in mind. Well, we're going to our break and our new song for this program. And I will be back to talk about Paul Eisen and also that German spy woman, Stube, when I get back. See you on the other side. Thank you. Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Gosh, this is Carolyn Yeager, and this is the Heretics Hour on Monday night on October 7th. And, you know, before the break, I totally did not remember what this new music that we had installed for the program. And wasn't that just great? Didn't that sound great? And it was Die Golden Sieben, a German swing orchestra, was active in the 30s. And they had a lot of great swing music in Germany. And I had if you want to find the more information about it in the YouTube, where you can see it on YouTube, go to the Heretics Hour program page at the White Network. I was trying to get there so I could tell you the name of these two songs, but I think I actually remember them. It was Vergiss, Die Tränen was the first song, and Heimweh, which means homesick, was the second song that was played. So I didn't need to go to my site anyway, but you'll find where you can find it on YouTube, or you can just, of course, type it in as GoldenSieben. Sieben. And so I thought it was, I think it's really nice music. It's great to listen to. So that's that. Now, I told you I was going to talk about Paul Eisen. And this is going to be what I cover in this hour is going to help throw some light on what I talked about in the first hour. I know it was a little bit, didn't seem like very good exposition there, but it was really a very simple idea that I wanted to get across, and there wasn't a whole lot else to say about it. But I think that as I look at all this, it will help us to understand, help you to understand why, the difference between somebody who's 100% behind the unifying idea that we have for us as white people and those who aren't and can't be, and what the problem is there and why what goes wrong. So I'm going to say that there's this man, Paul Eisen. Well, you know, I'm in a discussion. I am a part of a discussion group. Nobody does much discussion anymore, mostly just post things, including me. But Michael Santomaro is on this group, and he constantly, he considers himself a Holocaust revisionist, and in some sense a Holocaust denier, maybe. He's certainly been at it for a long, long time. A lot of people know him, and a lot of people, I suppose, respect him. Some people don't respect him so much, I've learned. I have my problems with him. But he posts things on this here by Paul Eisen, and I think he posts in a lot of places, and he has some places of his own, sites, and he posts, things that he thinks are good everywhere. And he posts the work of a lot of people that I don't like, and one of them is this Paul Eisen, spelled E-I-S-E-N. Another one who thinks Eisen is great, who spoke up about it, is Harvey Taylor, who is another revisionist. In fact, he used to be on Mark Weber's board of directors, at the IHR under Mark Weber as director, and he was on the board for a long time. And when there got to be a lot of criticism about it and so on, at some point he resigned, and he's not on the board anymore. And he's a very good guy, but he's gotten to where he supports a lot of people that I think are quite wrong. But he thinks because there's always this thing, because they're good on some things, then they're good. And I have a real problem, and you can almost find it with anybody you want to look at and look into, that if they're not good on all things, that they're not really good. You know, you can't just be good on some things and bad on some things. So, and then let's see, I had another name here. Oh yeah, it was Mark Weber. All right. Well, Mark Weber's another one who's not 100%. So, he's too afraid of criticism. So, in my opinion, and I've read some of Paul Eisen's things, and the one I want to talk about today is he has a blog article, which is not, is from like 2012. I am a Holocaust denier, he says, or why I'm a Holocaust denier, I think is the title of it. But in my opinion, he shows us how deep Jewish hatred of National Socialism goes. And it can never be reconciled. So, you know, when people talk about Holocaust, and a lot of these people, there are not a lot, but there are people like Paul Eisen, Jews, who have come around, and they're supposed to be these really good Jews who say, yeah, I have a problem with the Holocaust. I don't really agree with it. I think that there's problems with it and should be looked at and so on. But they only go so far with it. And a lot of non-Jews only go so far with it too, which I've brought up. So let's look at this. You know, what I'm saying is that Jewish hatred of National Socialism is really where it's at. They don't hate Germans so much, and they will say, well, you know, we can absolve a lot of them. You know, we can absolve a lot of this blame, you know, that Germany is stuck with. And although Germans are not quite willing to give it up, that's another sick part of it. But we can do that, but they do not stop wanting to blame National Socialism, and which means Adolf Hitler. And these two things can never be reconciled. Jews and National Socialism. Jews can never reconcile with National Socialism, Adolf Hitler. And why? Because he pointed out what they were. And he said they have to go. We can't have them. You know, we can't live with them. That's what they cannot ever, you know, accept. They never will. So they're absolute opposites. And Horst Mahler, that I'm not even going to try to explain who he is. If you don't know, look him up. You should know. Horst Mahler recognizes this, that they are opposites. But he sometimes calls it the German spirit and the Jewish spirit. But he'll also say he's also calls himself a National Socialist, says he's a National Socialist. But tries to, you know, say that somehow in some future time, because of God, because it's some kind of a thing that never, you can't have enemies forever, there's going to be some coming together and some Faustian synthesis or Hegelian synthesis where this opposition of the two will merge itself into something and synthesize. And I don't care for that. I don't care for that when he says that. And I don't see that as happening. I don't think it's inevitable or anything like that because of, you know, the universe has to solve all conflicts or something. I don't, but anyway, and I'm not wishing for it. I certainly am not wishing for Jews to get over their whatever it is bothering them and stop hating us or stop hating National Socialism, because I don't think they're capable of I don't think that's possible. I think it would always just be a trick and we would be the ones who are being fooled as usual. So Eisen says in this blog post of his, I am a Holocaust denier. And then he writes, I'm going to quote from it. He says, it's always worth defining your terms. Not that it does that much good, The inquisitors will see what they want to see and claim what they want to claim. But for the record, here's what I do and do not question. First, what I do not question. I do not question that the National Socialist regime brutally persecuted Jews. Well, there you go, right off the bat. This is not open to change. This is not open to question. The National Socialists brutally persecuted Jews, all right? And a lot of people will just go right along with that. Well, I used to. I didn't know any better. I thought, well, that must be true, you know, must be true. Oh, after all, we've heard about all this. But I don't now. And then his second point is, I do not question that Jews in Germany were discriminated against, violently assaulted, dispossessed, imprisoned in camps, and expelled, and that many Jews died as a result. Okay, pretty much just the same as the first one, only just in more words and a little more, you know, explanation, I guess, he thinks. And then his third point, thing that he does not question, he doesn't question that Jews in countries occupied by Germany or within the German sphere of influence were pitilessly assaulted, dispossessed, and subjected to brutal deportations, many to forced labor camps where many hundreds of thousands died. So that's the same as the other one, only, he drags this out. So that you have the Jews in Germany and then you have the Jews in occupied countries. He doesn't talk about people, only Jews, you know, other people, only Jews. Only Jews. And now he says, there's a fourth one, sorry. Sorry, I forgot this fourth one. I do not question that many Jews were executed by shooting in the East. So now he's including the shooting in the East because he's going to say he doesn't believe in the gas chambers. So he is going along with the shooting in the East. Doesn't question that. He says many though. He won't say how many. He doesn't know. You know, he's going by what his friends, and he does have friends who are revisionists. And these revisionists have told him and he's been, you know, he feels he must go along with this because the proof is there. So he's going by that. But then he says, here's what I do question. This is what he does question. I question that there ever was an official plan on the part of Hitler or any other part of the National Socialist regime systematically and physically to eliminate every Jew in Europe. And he questions that there ever existed homicidal gas chambers. And he questions the figure of 6 million Jews, Jewish victims in the Nazi assault. And he believes that the actual figure, because there were certainly, he believes there were victims, but the actual figure, was significantly less. How much less? He doesn't say. So this is the usual thing that we get now from the, you know, the new, left wing, and he's very left wing, the new left wing people who, some Jews, some not, who are starting to accept revisionism. And these three things are what they are willing to accept. So it's nothing surprising there. And then this is supposed to mean that since these three things are the backbone of Holocaust belief and Holocaustianity, that they hold on to these things as necessary conditions of the Holocaust. They did happen, even the 6 million, crazily. So you wonder why they would hold on to 6 million, but they do. Then he's, you know, he's doing a wonderful thing by denying that the Holocaust, but. You know, the problem is that there's more to it than that. So he's what you call an establishment-approved Holocaust revisionist or denier now. They're using that term. He's using it for himself, of the Kodo variety. And, you know, I have respect for what CODO, a Committee on Open Debate, for Open Debate on the Holocaust has done. And I respect, I have affection and liking for Bradley Smith. By the way, he didn't show up on Saturday's show because, he wrote to me that his, he did get back from the other side that night, but his daughter was, he was up all night with his sick daughter. His daughter lives with them and her two children. He just got finished looking after her or something. And that was like right before the show was going to start. And he said he was not in a position to be able to perform. So, he was sorry. Well, that was all right. He has a lot going on in his personal life, and you never know when it's going to pop up and take precedence. So, okay, so this is, you know, which I said, all right, I'm not going to repeat that. And finally, says Eisen, one more thing I do not question the horror of what was done to Jews by National Socialists or the right of Jews, including myself, to regard that horror any way they wish. I do, however, question their right to compel the rest of the world to feel the same. So he's, you know, he doesn't question that the Jews have a right to see what happened, supposedly what happened to them, with horror or with any way they wish, however bad they want to see it, whatever they want to do with it, they have the right to do with it. They can talk about it. They can form organizations. They can build museums. They can run camps. They can do all these things if they want. The only thing he doesn't agree with, or he does question, is that they have the right to compel the rest of the world to feel the same. Now, is this really effective? They don't, of course, everybody knows they don't have the right to compel the rest of the world to feel the same, but they have the means to do so through control of the worldwide media, basically, and certainly the Western media, and through control of governments, mostly through their bank control of banking and the creation of money and running all the central banks and so on. You know, they are able to not give another, they're able to show only one point of view, and that's how they compel people. So what he's saying here really doesn't help anything at all. You know, I could accuse him of being deceitful on purpose. But I'm not accusing him of being deceitful on purpose, because he may be doing what he thinks he's doing something really fine here. But he doesn't understand that it doesn't, you know, what's wrong with it. He doesn't understand why it's really still not, doesn't answer the problems for white people. And I want to say that, he is concerned. And of course, it's always that the National Socialists are not going to be left off the hook. Because what all this was done by National Socialists, and once again, National Socialists equates to Adolf Hitler. So that is not let off the hook, but some of this story is because it's already being known to be unbelievable, you know. And it's another thing that these Jews know, that they can't pass this on forever. I think they do know that. And so that's why they're trying to change the story somewhat, and they're doing these other things. One thing, as I said in the beginning, don't forget, what they hate most of all, they hate with the passion and will never, ever be able to reconcile themselves to, and that's National Socialism. Because National Socialism was the only political philosophy that took control of a country and became a, you know, major power and became popular all around the world. Is National Socialism is quite popular, that absolutely denies them the rights that they want to have in our countries. So I have to move on here. Today, you know, like I say, he wrote this last year, and he doesn't always write about this, but most of the time, he's concerned with Palestinian suffering, and he goes on about that a lot today. And he's not really concerned with German suffering, and he's certainly not concerned with white people's suffering. He is concerned with Jewish suffering and with some non-white suffering, as the Jews always do. And he can't even see white suffering, white people's. He is in no way sympathetic with the genocide of white people, or he would deny it, or the destruction of Europe as the homeland of whites. I don't know what he's ever commented on that. And nobody forces him to, you know. No, people are just these softy people, like, say, Santamaro, Michael Santamaro, and you know, a friend of his is a friend of this guy, a friend of Eisen's is Gilad Atzmon, sort of. I don't know how friendly they are, but, you know, they associate. And he's not going to make him talk. He's not concerned with the plight of white people or any kind of white genocide. Never. He's only concerned with Palestinians. And they go up against Israel. That's it, period. You know, and because it's racist. Because it's racist. So they equate that with Hitler and National Socialism. So we have to keep this in mind. After Eisen says all this about Hulk in his Holocaust article, he ends up with, and I'm quoting him, "But for me, Holocaust denier is a label I accept. This is not because I don't think anything bad happened to Jews at the hands of the National Socialists." He repeats this again and again. "For what it's worth, the real story of brutal ethnic cleansing moves me far more than any Holocaust. And it's certainly not because I think any such assault is right and proper." Well, you see, he just doesn't get it, or he doesn't want to get it. But he finds this brutal ethnic cleansing, well, that's a Holocaust in itself, you know. Might not call it that. Maybe he's say he would like to get rid of that word Holocaust and call it something else. But it's still the victimization on a large, large scale that is unforgivable of the Jews in Europe. If you think that the Jews belong in Europe. You know, if you don't think the Jews belong in Europe, then you're going to see it totally differently. But this never even occurs to these people. Not that it doesn't occur to them, but they're not going to bring it up as a possibility to be considered. So now, something that I found really interesting about this Eisen was his commenting on his own Jewish experience. I think this was from a different blog post, or it might have been at the bottom of this one on Holocaust denial, but he wrote, "Because mine was," he was talking about his family, and he is English, has a very definite English accent. He looks very Jewish, though, and we know how comfortable the Jews are in Britain, in all of the United Kingdom. We know how comfortable they are there, how they feel right at home. You know, they've been at home for a long time, and they have all these organizations and all this power. So he says, he's writing about his family and his upbringing, his child, you know, what kind of Jewish household he grew up in. And he says, "Because mine was no run-of-the-mill Zionism," period. "What was claimed by so many Jews, particularly of the anti-Zionist Marxist variety," because see, there were a lot of these left-wing Jews who weren't Zionists, "to be an essentially political ideology, just a Jewish version of imperialism or an add-on," things he doesn't agree with, "an essentially practical solution to an ever-present anti-Semitism, was for me, and I now know deep down for most Jews, a deep emotional, spiritual, even religious affiliation." So he is admitting here, if you call it admitting, I mean, he's letting us know that he is all Jew, and that he found that his when he encountered any kind of anti-Semitism, which he thinks is ever present, he also admitted previous to this that he had become a real Zionist. He was the biggest Zionist in his family as a young fellow. He was the one that, you know, was really pro-Israel more than anybody else in his family. But he says he's gotten over that now. But he's saying here that his reaction to the non-Jews around him was this, and he says all Jews have this deep down, a deep emotional, spiritual, even religious affiliation, because I guess he's not religious. And he says, for my Zionism was a true sense of my Jewishness, a feeling that came deep from within Jewish history and even destiny, a feeling that I, with all Jews, had stood at the foot of Mount Sinai, and also with all Jews had marched through history, a history which at the time I had not yet dreamt of questioning. Of course, he's implying that he has questioned some of that since, but he's putting this very clearly, that for Jews, their Jewishness is deep, deep within them, and their sense of Jewish history and Jewish destiny. And he says this is a feeling that he shares with all Jews, and he feels that with all Jews, they've all together marched through history. You know, and their difficult history that they see it as, and so on. So this is extreme. I'm trying to point out here what I see in this, I should say, is an extreme loyalty to being Jewish, which we in the know they have, but they try often to deny or minimize or distract from. And my comment on this is that, you know, does it occur to them? Does it occur to this Eisen or to any of them that the people they live among, let's say, for example, the Germans or any other people, but I'm going to use the Germans as the example, also have a deep emotional, spiritual affiliation for their national identity and more their land and their common history? And the Germans go back, the German people go back, way back into... you know, I don't know, Roman times and pre-Roman times and so on. So, you know, they have a long sense, and you know, of themselves, and that these Jews don't share, you know. We don't share in this feeling of Jewishness that these Jews feel so deeply. They don't share in this feeling that we have about our people and our land and our identity and so on, and our history together. But no, it doesn't occur to them to think about this. They're too self-centered, including, you know, Paul Eisen, who thinks he's such a good man. You know, oh, he's so sensitive. He's so fair. He's so this and that, you know. Does it occur to these Jews and to him that a great and old people like the Germans don't want Jews taking over their country? And when they take it back from the Jews, when the Jews have been taking it over, the Jews resist and start making war on them from outside their country, let alone inside as much as they can through treason and so on, but also from outside all over the world, getting the cooperation of Jews from all over the world. And when the German people have to forcibly remove the Jews so that they can have their country and their society and their culture to themselves, it's considered a crime against humanity. And on it goes. And this is exactly what Eisen was saying in his earlier stuff about all the suffering of the Jews. Does it occur to people why that was done? Does it? No, the people don't want to talk about, well, some do, but not many, talk about how the, you know, if you say the Jews brought it on themselves. So how can we, if the Jews have brought this on themselves by insisting on being in other people's lands because they say, well, we came here, you know, several generations ago and we're part of this country now. but most of them weren't that, hadn't even been there that long. But when, you know, when other people have this, these deep feelings about their, who they are and their place in the world, that's, they don't have a right to do it anymore. And this Paul Eisen does not recognize that right, or that any of these distinctions. And a lot of these people, who, are supposed to be on the side of white people, but somehow can't bring themselves to see the whole, you know, to see it all the way through, are the same. So we have to look at what's right and good first. You know, what is right and good? What is right and good for us? What's right and good for white people is not going to be what non-white people see as what is right and good. They're going to see it differently. And Jews are, in fact, a disloyal alien population within the countries in which they abide by choice. They went there, and Paul Eisen is not even a loyal English subject because of his feelings of Jewishness, but he gets along fine because the Jewish elites run that country. Well, I'm going to have to quit on that. Well, there's a little bit here about Michael Hoffman. This is also by David, by Paul Eisen. Paul Eisen also wrote this, Michael Hoffman was quoting him, but this is in a blog by Paul Eisen, where he's posting Michael Hoffman's comments about this letter from Rabbi Obadiah. And this Rabbi Obadiah is a incredibly racist Jew who he outwardly is talking about, he's a big time, he was, I think he died, big time rabbi in Israel, but he outwardly comes out with all this stuff that he's the one that says, you know, Gentiles are only created to serve Jews, and they don't have any other purpose, and, you know, Jews have to totally rule, and the Gentiles are to serve them and do all the work and do this and that while they sit and, you know, eat and drink and so on. And so Paul Eisen, in writing a preliminary to this, an introduction to this, says, I grew up in a delightful Jewish community, full of gentle Jews, as Mark Ellis used to call them. Did my mom and dad and all their friends have some fear and disdain for their non-Jewish neighbors? Of course they did. But would they have recognized the ravings of old Rabbi Obadiah? Not in a million years. Well, that's supposed to make them look better. But, you know, they don't go along with Rabbi Obadiah. But it's interesting that he has such a positive view of Jewishness, this Paul Eisen. I mean, extremely, you know, he thinks that there are all these gentle Jews in the community that he grew up in England. And, yet his parents and all their friends still had fear and disdain for their non-Jewish neighbors. That's it, you know, and they all feel justified because they see anti-Semitism everywhere, and they can't stop seeing anti-Semitism. So they don't like non-Jews. They don't trust non-Jews, but they live there because it's beneficial to them, because they have so many, you know, life is so good for them in European countries and in America and so on. And then he says, of course, this madness of Obadiah, I guess, informs to varying degrees the thoughts and feelings of all Jews. But in my view, it'd be a mistake to look for this kind of overt lunacy in all those Jews you know and love. So he's even saying that this kind of madness is in all Jews. But mostly they're not, they don't go that far, so you should still love them because, you know, they're lovable. All right. I want to talk about this crazy business in Germany. You know, Germany is not Germany. Germany is, Germany ceased being Germany. And if we don't have, you know, the aim of the white elites who, maybe I don't need to say this, but the white elites who hang out, who cooperate with the Jew world order, Germany is an example of the situation that all whites are going to be in, where they have cannot experience a pleasure in any of their in national identity, except for football teams and you know, beer fest, Oktoberfest, and Wiener Schnitzel, and so on, crap like that, you know. But anything real, no, because that's racist, and you're not including all these other people who want to come here and be Germans, who are actually, you know, Turks and other things. So you know, you can't do that. And this is the future. But here we have something so far out that this this was in Der Spiegel. I saw it last night, I think. And so I wanted to include it today. And I'll just read this, you know, and then I'll talk about it a little bit. German Foreign Ministry may honor anti-Hitler Soviet spy. She's a Soviet spy, but if she was anti-Hitler, then they want to give her a special honor. And it says on the first floor of the German Foreign Ministry, there's a white wall on which 12 names are listed. They are foreign ministry staff, all Germans who were murdered by the Nazis, that's how they word it, and honored, but and they're now honored as active resistance fighters. You know, if you are against the Nazis, and if the Nazis executed you for your treasonous activities, then you're now seen as an active resistance fighter and hero. And so they've got these 12 names on this white wall on the first floor of the German Foreign Ministry currently. Now, they want to maybe add a 13th name, and that would be Ilse Strube. Strube should be Strube. Strube. That's what I'm going to say. And, yeah, like Huss, Strube. But it's harder to do with after an ST. Strube, I'll just use a U sound, worked in the ministry's information department for several months, in 1940. You know, and then in 1940, she was executed by beheading, which was the common thing to do, and it had been for a long time, and still was after the war for a while, in Berlin's notorious Plötzensee jail. The educated, attractive, and courageous journalist was one of the most important German spies working for Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. She repeatedly warns, and this is, I checked this out on Wikipedia, and so whatever is the going story about this woman, that's, it was the same there. She repeatedly warned Stalin's military intelligence service, the MRU, about the looming German assault on the Soviet Union. She, so the core of her resistance activity consisted of the betrayal of secrets. This was in the article. She was betraying the secrets that she was able to find out, whatever they were. They might not have been too good, but from Germany, and this was in 1940, to the Soviet Union. And so the article asks, should the German government honor such a person? It's kind of controversial a little bit that she should, her name should go up there in Germany. And they say Germany political parties have been debating the issue in recent years. The opposition left party in particular has been calling for Strube's inclusion. The left party, guess, you know, that's not surprising. And now has the IFZ Institutes, that's a historical institute, and it's probably kind of left-wing too, they have written an assessment that backs this argument that she should be included. And a IFZ historian, Elke Scherz-Janoy, it doesn't sound like a German name. I don't know. Scherz is German, but it ends with J-A-N-O-I. It doesn't, I don't know what kind of a name that is, but she's, could be from somewhere else. Lots, you know, these people who are not loyal at all to Germany get these positions in Germany now, and particularly in writing history and so on. And like that one I talked about, before on, who wrote the book, Wendy Lauer, she's busy in Germany as a historian and so on. Anyway, this Elke Scherz-Janoy wrote that the conditions for a public honoring of Ilse Struve in Germany are given. I don't know what she means that they're just, it's just obvious or something. And she goes as far as to place the agent alongside the siblings of Hans and Sophie Scholl, students who were executed in 1943 for distributing flyers against the war and Hitler. Now, that's unbelievable that somebody who was working for Stalin, passing information, should be honored. But not only that, they prefer Stalin to Hitler, you know, in Germany, because Stalin was one of the allies at that time. And in today's Germany, all the allies were heroes working to defeat Germany because Hitler had taken it over and, you know, was destroying Germany. So he needed to be stopped. That was the most important thing. But what's worse is that it's a fact that this Struve had already been recruited for the GRU, the Soviet spy agency, in 1931. By her friend, this communist, Rudolf Herrnstadt. Now that he's a German name. So, you know, there are a lot of communists in Germany. A lot of these people put in concentration camps, right after Hitler was, in 1933 became chancellor. And during that first year, a lot of these people were communists. Now the fact that a lot of the communists were Jews, is the reason that a lot of them were Jews. You know, but they never say that. They just say he went after Jews right away and started putting him in concentration camps, which is not correct. He was trying to help them leave the country. And they had all these programs going, you know, to go to Israel, go here, go there, go anywhere. That's what he was trying to do. Not probably knowing, but not knowing what else he could do, anything better to do, because even though you send Jews out of the country, they're still going to be working against you, just as effectively, practically. But at least they wouldn't be in the country where you had this going on. So I guess it was considered an improvement. So since this woman had become a spy in 1931, before Hitler came to power, she was truly just a communist. And she was trying to bring down, as they say here, the democratically elected, the social democrat government, what was left still of the Weimar, you know, governments. So, you know, it wasn't just Hitler. And this is something that some people are bringing up. And, you know, here, her story real quick, you know, she, at 19, she was working as a secretary for the Jewish author and journalist Theodor Wolff. Now, I don't know if she herself is Jewish. She could be, but there's not much, you know, information about her, and nothing said that she was. So she might not have been, because a lot of these Germans were just communists. And then he was editor of the Berliner Tagblatt newspaper, which was a liberal democratic paper. And she was passing on inside information then to her GRU agent, which she met on a weekly basis. Which she picked up gossip and this and that, whatever she found out, she'd pass on. And then it says, when Hitler came to power, Wolf, the Jewish journalist, fled the country, and Struve quit the newspaper, and she started traveling around Europe, presumably as a courier for the GRU, So, you know, what kind of a heroine is this? And then she moved to Warsaw, where her friend Hermstadt was. And he was busy obtaining information from the German diplomat, Rudolf von Schelliha, who mistakenly thought Hermstadt was spying for the British, and all on and on. You know, so these people were just spies, and they were trying to turn, you know, German diplomats into all cooperating with them. And a lot of them, you know, some of them did. And, you know, Moscow was very popular with a lot of people at that time, even in spite of all that they've done. So here's the kind of person that that they are wanting to put on their wall. They wall, like she was a victim of the Nazis, who worked in the Foreign Service for like 2 months, you know, and yet they're pushing. And who's pushing? All those left wingers in Germany, all those people, you know, that we know so well. And this is why, just one more reason why we need to be very strong and unified in something. And there's nothing better than what I was recommending at the beginning of the program. I just have a little bit of time, not much, but because they brought up Sophie and Hans Scholl again, and I've always been sorry that I didn't, finish reading some of this good material in this book that Patty Goldstein sent me, The White Rose. And I'm going to take this opportunity to read as much as I can. And what I failed to read was the grounds for the second three that were found guilty, Schmorell, Graf, and the Professor Huber. So I'm going to see how far I can get here. These sentences, well, this is like an introduction, and then they go over when they were giving this sentence. This was in court. The judge was reading out, you know, or whoever was reading it out, the grounds for the sentences, and then the sentences and so on. And they covered what they had done for Hans and Sophie, and that Christoph Probst, and that so on and so forth. So I'm going to start here, because I think I read some of this on that other show that I did about them. So I'm going to start here where he's talking to these three, and also the others, because there was about 12 of them, but these were the only three that got the death penalty. But the court record says today, and it was read out in court, today the People's Court has, and this is also to show the way National Socialism works. I'm not trying to cover up the way National Socialism worked. It was a different, very different way from what we are used to and what we think we have in the Western democracies. They didn't, you know, it was not the same kind of system. So he says, today the People's Court and the people, well, I'm not even going to explain the People's Court. The People's Court has had to render judgment on a second part of the core group. This organization, the light is getting the right light here. One, Schmorell, who acted approximately in the same way as Scholl. Two, Graf, who collaborated treasonously and in aid of the enemy to almost the same degree as Schmorell and Scholl. Both had been assigned by the armed services to the study of medicine. Both ought to have been particularly grateful to the Führer, for he ordered army pay for them during the time of their university attendance, as was true for all enlistees assigned to medical study. Inclusive of money for food, they received over 250 marks per month, and exclusive of money for food, but with rations and goods, it still amounted to about 200 marks. Well, the first one was inclusive of money for food, and the second one was exclusive of money for food. Sorry if I read that wrong. More than most students ordinarily receive from home. Both were sergeants. Both were assigned to student companies. Alongside them is a man who is supposed to be an educator, the erstwhile Professor Huber, self-styled philosopher, a man whose influence on his students in his own specialty may have been good. We have neither the need nor the knowledge to judge his professional competence. But a German university professor is first and foremost an educator of the young. As such, he ought to try, in time of difficulty and struggle, to see that our university students are training to be worthy younger brothers of the soldiers of 1914 at Longmark in Flanders, that they are reinforced in their absolute trust in our Führer, our people, and our Reich, and that they become seasoned fighters prepared for any sacrifice. The accused Huber, however, acted in an exactly opposite manner. He nourished doubt instead of dispelling it. He delivered addresses about federalism and democracy for Germany, about a multi-party system, instead of teaching and setting an example in his own life of rigorous national socialism. It was not a time for tackling theoretical problems, but rather for grasping the sword. Yet he sowed doubt among our youth. He helped to publish a treasonous leaflet of the resistance movement, and he himself wrote another entitled Students. Admittedly, he strongly desired the retention of a sentence he had written, wherein he urged the student body to give their services unstintingly to the armed services. But the fact that he included this sentence does not exonerate him, for here he was playing the game of pitting the army against the Führer and the NSDAP, which was attacked and slandered most viciously later in the leaflet. Therefore, the fact that the accused students deleted this sentence against his will does not excuse him in the least. Whoever tells the German army to turn against National Socialism intends to sap its strength, for the might of the army rests on the National Socialist philosophy of our soldiers. That is the basis of the indomitable strength of our National Socialist revolutionary troops. A professor of this sort, in the view of those great advocates of duty among all German academics, Fichte and Kant, is a blemish upon German scholarship, a blot which a few days ago was erased in connection with these proceedings. He was removed from his post in disgrace, meaning Huber, Professor Huber, and was stripped of his professorial rights and privileges. Huber further states that he believed he was performing a good deed, but we will not relapse into the error of the Weimar interregnum, which looked upon traitors as men of honor and safeguarded such so-called conscientious objectors by sending them off for detention in fortresses. And this is very important here. He says, the days when every man can be allowed to profess his own political beliefs are past. Now, this would sound shocking to a lot of people. And it would make some people just stop and pause and say, well, now, wait a minute. Do we want this? But this is what it is. Because it's time of war, but there are other reasons. I'll repeat that. The days when every man can be allowed to profess his own political beliefs are past. You see, because if every man in a nation like Germany under National Socialism was free to say, well, I don't agree with this. I think a different way. I'm thinking another way. I want to think this way. Then that's how you get all these political parties. And they were the political parties, except for the National Socialist Party, was outlawed. For that very reason, to keep everything, you know, together. For us, there is but one standard, he says, the National Socialist one. Against this, we measure each man. Schmorell talks nonsense. This is an interesting part. Schmorell talks nonsense about his mother's being Russian and that he is therefore part Russian. He wanted somehow to bring Germans and Russians together. This was his excuse. The extent of bottomless confusion in which he finds himself is indicated by the statement he made at the principal trial that, as a German soldier, he had made up his mind not to fire upon either Germans or Russians. The National Socialist system of justice carefully investigates the personality of the accused, but these investigations can and should not enter into eccentric, unrealistic, and anti-German attitudes. The People's Court must ascertain above all that no such rift in time of war shall ever again be opened in our nation. Schmorell is a German soldier He has taken his oath of duty to the Führer. He was allowed to continue his studies at the expense of the community at large. He has no right to any mental reservations about being half Russian. In any case, the morality of reservatio mentalis is not allowed in a German court. Well, there you go. You can't have mental reservations about things based on some moral code of your own, right? That's what they say. Groff at least had the courage at the end of the principal trial to declare that there's no excuse for his crime, but his crime is so grave that this insight, coming so late, cannot alter the judgment. And he says, in particular, they talk about the three, talk some more about him, and then they give, say that the penalty is death. I'm sorry, I can't read any more, but I had some more of a doubt that I thought was good. But we've got 10 seconds or less, so I want to thank you for listening today, and I hope it doesn't sound as bad as it seems like it does to me, and that you got something out of it. So we'll see you again next time. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.